Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for joining us. What about the children? Who's looking out for kids when their moms and or dads get into trouble with the law or through some court action, find themselves wrenched away from their homes and their families? Who represents the best interest of abused and neglected children throughout an entire court case? Quite often, it's people like Melinda Jameson. Melinda is the executive director of the Lexington branch of the national nonprofit Court-Appointed Special Advocates, CASA. She was named 2018's National CASA Executive Director of the Year for the entire United States. So she knows her way around this issue. And thanks for joining us, Melinda.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell us what you do.
Absolutely. And I'll clarify to say it's really the volunteers and the staff of CASA that are doing that amazing work. And we use CASA volunteers to advocate for abused and neglected children that find themselves in the family court system, which, as you mentioned, is often due to no fault of their own.
So what's the difference between a CASA caseworker and a state child protective services caseworker?
Well, first off, our CASA volunteers are just that. They're volunteers, so they are unpaid to do this work. So they are 100% there because they believe in the best interest of the children. But secondly, the roles differ. So by state statute, it defines what a CASA volunteer or advocate does. And like you said, we are solely there for what's in the safe and permanent interest of these children. State social workers by mandate are required to work towards reunification with the biological parents. The CASA volunteer is not, although we are all for reunification with the biological parents if it's a safe and permanent option. Unfortunately, sometimes it's not a safe and permanent option, and we're going to start to look at other options, whether that's a relative, whether it's maybe an adoption of the child. And then secondly, caseworkers, social workers, that is a hard job. They are overburdened, especially in Kentucky and in the counties we serve, Fayette, Bourbon, Woodford, no different. Here in Fayette County, it's quite common for a state social worker to have 60 cases. Mm-hmm. An average case has 2.5 children, so they are spread very thin.
And isn't the federal guideline more like about 30?
30 is supposed to be the average. You are correct. And even whether it's 30 or 60, these children can be spread all over the state because even if it's in Fayette County, there are not enough foster homes here. If the child is placed in a residential treatment facility, there are none located in Fayette County. And if a relative is identified, they might be outside of the county as well. So you have to keep in mind the state social workers as well as CASA volunteers. Right here in Fayette County, we have many driving 3 hours each direction to visit with these children. So it's really impossible for these state social workers to invest the amount of time that a CASA volunteer can because most CASA volunteers have one case. They're required to see the child or children at least one time per month, but many have more frequent visits than that with them.
Lots to talk about here. First of all, I caught on the word volunteer. This is really hard, even dangerous work, right?
It is, and that's why National CASA has prepared a curriculum that we go by. So the initial training, which is called the pre-service training, is 30 hours. So a lot of people balk at that because 30 hours is not just showing up and then going to the volunteer work. The reason for that 30 hours of training is because, as you said, this is hard work. And so we're going to talk about safety and security. That's a component of the training. We're going to look at minimum sufficient level of care, meaning many folks that come in don't have any social work background, and we are all for reunification of the children with their biological families, again, if it's a safe and permanent option. So we're going to talk about, although this might not look like the family you grew up in, Is this meeting the children's needs? Is it an okay environment for the children to go back into? We're going to talk about diversity. We're going to talk about educational advocacy. We find ourselves with many of the children we're advocating for as they've been moved from foster home to foster home and switched school districts. Maybe they need an individual education plan in the school, and no one has taken the time to identify that. A real good example, we had a 7-year-old little girl that the school system was looking at removing her from the regular class and putting her in remedial coursework. The CASA volunteer got involved and realized she needed eyeglasses. No one had ever taken the time to see that. We recommended it, and the judge ordered that. And within 2 weeks, this young lady was moved into the advanced reading group.
How about that?
For her, education can break her out of this generational cycle that she was born into. But it's that a common everyday citizen that has the time to invest to see, oh, wow, it's a matter of the child needs eyeglasses.
That training, I'm wondering, you just touched on the surface of what must go on a daily basis at CASA and with your volunteers. Does the training involve learning how not to let yourself become overly empathetic to become involved in that child's life? I would think that'd be really difficult.
Absolutely. That's a piece of the training, talking about boundaries, as well as we have national CASA standards, Kentucky CASA network standards, and Kentucky revised statutes that state what a CASA volunteer does and doesn't do. So after that 30-hour training, a volunteer is matched with a volunteer manager, which is a paid staff person. That person guides them through the process. So when they initially get assigned a case, they're going to sit down and meet with them. And a CASA volunteer always has the right to say yes or no if they want to take a case. So they'll go over the specifics, the number of children, how old they are, why they came into care, where they're placed at. And if a volunteer says, okay, I'll take this case, that volunteer manager then goes on the first home visit with them and guides them through the process. That volunteer manager always attends court with them, assists them with preparing their court report, because CASA volunteers write court reports that has information on the families and the children, and at the end, they make recommendations. Those recommendations help the judges make more informed decisions, which is how the entire CASA program originated in Seattle, Washington, when a judge felt like he did not have enough information to make lifelong decisions on behalf of these children. So that volunteer manager or staff person is really there to guide them through the process. We also go over what our policies and procedures are and what we do as CASA volunteers and what we do not do. So, for example, we do not transport children. And that's something we emphasize over and over. And when a volunteer completes that 30 hours of training, they sign on that they understand these rules and some of the boundaries in place. We also have that ongoing support of that volunteer manager or staff member for them to make sure that rules are being followed. Because in the nature of volunteers, sometimes people misstep. So we're there to bring you back to what it is we're supposed to be doing. And all CASA volunteers are required to have 12 ongoing continuing education hours every year. So we offer those at least monthly at our office here in Lexington, as well as we have webinars folks can participate in, lots of training opportunities outside of CASA, and books and videos that they can check out specific to subjects they might encounter.
So what is a caseworker's typical caseload?
So a state social worker or a CASA volunteer?
A CASA volunteer.
A CASA volunteer typically has one case, but one case could have one child. It could have 11 children. Yes, we have a few cases with 11 children. So biological siblings are kept together on a case, and they will get the same CASA volunteer except under two circumstances. If a sibling has perpetrated on another sibling, they would get separate CASA volunteers due to conflict of interest. And then in the case of we have that 11 sibling set, we have a couple of 7 sibling sets. They're not always all placed in the same home. So they could even be in multiple counties. So sometimes when that's the case, we might put 2 or maybe even 3 CASA volunteers to divide it up, because you can imagine driving to Williamsburg and then up to Northern Kentucky. That's a lot to put on one person that's a volunteer.
Are the children that you work with often placed in the position of serving as witnesses in cases against loved ones, a parent, a sibling?
That's a good question. So here in Kentucky, a child does have to testify against their perpetrator often in cases. And so typically a perpetrator is known to these children. It could be dad. It could be a significant other or a relative or someone known to the family. That can be incredibly traumatic for children. So think about the scenario if one has been sexually abused and maybe this has been occurring for months, or even if it were once, and having to sit in front of that person and testify to what has happened, which at Casa of Lexington, we are blessed to have the only courthouse facility dog in the state of Kentucky. And her name is Matilda. She's a yellow lab that went through 2 years of training through Canine Companions for Independence. And what's so wonderful about her is she's trained that if a child has to testify, she can go into the box with them and downstay for up to 4 hours and provide a level of comfort for them. We can turn over the leash so the child takes control of her for that. She can also go if the child has to have a forensic interview to substantiate sexual abuse or a medical exam, or even on a home visit if the child's having a tough day. We had a call from one of our schools. We also serve Bourbon and Woodford counties in addition to Fayette. And one of our schools in Bourbon County had a little girl that came in after a weekend and was having a really tough day and wouldn't talk. And we got a call and were able to take Matilda over. And when we got there, within 15 seconds of seeing Matilda, everything came out because the child was quick to tell Matilda, who was easy to trust, versus a human that, and in these cases, many of our children have been hurt by people. And so they're more apt to talk to the dog. But so when the children have to testify in regards to your question, Matilda can be a huge help. We have a young man that's 9 that is going to need to testify against his stepfather. And when the CASA volunteer and the social worker were explaining this to him, the first question he asked is, can Matilda go with me?
Wow. Matilda is super dog.
Yeah, she's sort of a rock star. We say we have the CASA superhero run at CASA Lexington, where all kids need heroes, abused kids need superheroes. But Matilda truly is a superhero, as are our CASA volunteers for these children.
Is she pretty busy?
Matilda stays quite busy. Now, she is only allowed to work 20 hours per week. There are standards on these trained dogs. And she keeps that 20 hours pretty hot. She also sees quite a bit of the Commonwealth, even though we're serving Fayette, Woodford, and Bourbon. As I mentioned, children can be placed around the state. So when she's working, she has her official Canine Companions for Independence vest on. And when she's at home, she gets to take that vest off, and that means she's not working and can unwind. And she lives with her handler, who is our staff member, Liz Knopfsinger, who is one of our volunteer managers.
Okay, let's bookmark it right there, and we'll be back in a moment for more conversation with Melinda Jameson, Executive Director of the Lexington Branch of Court-Appointed Special Advocates. Also ahead,
the decennial census, it's part of the Constitution that every 10 years we have to count every resident that lives within our borders.
Kentucky Youth Advocates Patricia Tannen with us, along with David Prince, a member of the Lawrence County Complete Count Committee. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Let's get back to my conversation with Melinda Jameson. She's the executive director of the Lexington branch of CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. She oversees the training and supervision of people who volunteer their time and energies to advocate for children who are victims of abuse and neglect. We know that opioid, meth, and other addictions are wreaking havoc on families in Lexington, all over the region for that matter. How does addiction figure into the CASA caseload?
We've absolutely seen an increase in the number of substantiated cases that are coming into all of our courts over the past several years directly related to this issue. We've seen also correlated with that a rise in cases with homelessness that are a component of the opioid issue leading to homelessness and then children not having a place to reside. Addiction is in about 90% of the cases that we serve on. So it's definitely a big issue, not only here in Fayette County and the counties we serve, but across the Commonwealth.
The children that you work with spend less time in foster care. Why is that?
So last year, we're very proud for the state of Kentucky. A child with a CASA volunteer spent 5.5 months less in out-of-home care. So that is so much better for the children because what that means is they receive permanency faster for that safe and permanent home. And I don't know about you, but think about, I don't even do well when my husband switches the restaurant we're going to eat at. But think about not knowing where you're going to spend the evening. Will I eat tonight? What school will I go to tomorrow? Am I going to be moved from homes tonight and end up in another place? So not only is that permanency better for our children, one of our 17-year-old CASA advocated children said it best when her CASA volunteer was talking with her and she was flunking out of her coursework. And the CASA volunteer said, we really need to be thinking about what's going to happen next when you graduate, and talked her into taking the ACT, and she got a 32. So we have a young lady with a 32 on the ACT but flunking out of her coursework, and the CASA volunteer said, what's going on? And she said to her CASA, how can I focus on calculus when I don't know where I'm sleeping tonight or if I'll eat? And so that right there, permanency, 5.5 months faster. For some of our little ones that are born into the system, 5.5 months could be 20% of their life, if you think about that. And also, it's a huge cost savings. The average cost of 1 month of foster care here in Kentucky for a child is right at $2,100. So 100 kids times 5.5 months times $2,100, we're looking at over $1 million. And that's for 100 children. We had just at 1,500 new substantiations of child abuse and child neglect in Fayette County alone last year.
So, let me make sure I understand this. The reason that these children end up spending less time in foster care is because they have a CASA worker who's kind of digging down into what's going on in their life where otherwise they might not have that kind of particular attention?
Correct. So the work of CASA is unduplicated. So if a CASA volunteer is not assigned to a child, they're not receiving that service anywhere else. And as we mentioned, most CASA volunteers have one case, so they're able to spend a whole lot more time involved on the case. As you said, dig to detail. So in one example, we had a case with the infant, and the court system was looking at putting the infant back into the home with the mother. And the report that had come in, not from CASA, had said that mom had gotten housing and she had a job and transportation to take this infant to her appointments and all. Well, the CASA volunteer got involved in looking at PVA records. Not only was this house really not legally the biological mother's, there was no running water. This was a case in December with an infant, so there'd be no hot water for bathing. Mom did not have transportation to take this child to her medical appointments. And so there was a bit of a front that was presented for a while, but it wasn't reality. And the CASA volunteer had more time to follow through on that and see what was really going on. Also, CASA volunteers having one case can spend a lot more time advocating for best interest. I know we talked about the example with the eyeglasses. That seems like a small thing, but it had sort of fallen through the cracks and not come to the attention of anyone else. But these glasses made a huge difference for this child to remain in the regular classroom. And as we said, education can break her out of that cycle. Another quick example, we had a little guy that was 2 that was born with a lot of medical issues, had been in about 13 different foster homes. Well, when he arrived at his most recent foster home, the foster mother did not have access to all the medical records before he was in his care, and there seemed to be something going on. Well, the CASA volunteer could get all of those medical records, and what we ended up finding out is the little fella had some liver damage when he was born, but he was no longer receiving his medication for that because it had simply fallen through the cracks. But thanks to the work of the CASA volunteer, we were able to recognize that and get him back on the correct medicine.
That's wonderful. I wonder, it seems as though these caseworkers are sometimes entering into very fraught, emotionally difficult scenarios and situations. Can it be dangerous for them?
Security is definitely, and safety is a component of the initial training. We would never send in a CASA volunteer to a situation where we think that there are safety concerns. In cases where there are major safety concerns, typically the child has been removed from that home and is in foster care or with a relative or in a residential treatment. So that's where the CASA volunteer would be going to visit. In a case, we do visit the biological parents, even if the child is not placed with them, but say in a situation where maybe there were murder charges, we would not just roll into an apartment to meet with someone. Typically, the meeting would occur at the attorney's office, and we would send the staff member with the volunteer, and another staff member would know what time the meeting was starting and it would end. And so we take a whole lot of precautions. Our program at CASA of Lexington has been in operation since 1986, and we've never had a safety issue. But that does not mean that we take it lightly. We're absolutely going to go in prepared. Yes, that Girl Scout motto, always be prepared.
Well, I'm still fascinated by the fact that these are volunteers. What kind of person becomes a court-appointed special advocate?
So you have to be at least 21 years of age to be an advocate. You have to be willing to go through that 30 hours of pre-service training. You have to be willing to allow us to run various background checks on you. And then you take an oath of confidentiality because the information is confidential that you'll be working with. And we ask that you commit to 2 years because the average length of a case is 2 years, and we want the same CASA volunteer involved with the children from case open to case closed, because so many times these children see a rotating sea of faces, whether it's foster homes, social workers, therapists, etc. So we want to be a constant for the child. So that's the commitments that we ask you to make, and we always say anyone is welcome to come talk with us to try out the training. We always have folks go through the training and decide it's not the best fit for them. We don't get upset about that. We feel like that means you leave more informed, because one of the biggest issues we have is people are very unaware of how big of a deal child abuse and child neglect is everywhere, but here in Kentucky, in Fayette, Bourbon, and Woodford counties. And people are quick to say, oh, that must be the eastern part of the state. Absolutely, they have challenges too, but Fayette County has the second highest number of substantiated cases in Kentucky, which makes sense. We're the second largest county. Mm-hmm. But family court is closed, so people typically never hear about these cases. People are shocked to hear the situations we have. We had an 11-year-old child that had a baby. It was her father's baby. We've had multiple cases where children have been kept in pet carriers. That's here, our community, Fayette County. Yes.
Shocking. How is CASA supported?
That's a great question. So we largely rely on individual donations. So we have individuals, businesses that support us. We have two primary events at CASA of Lexington. The CASA Superhero Run, which we touched on briefly, that takes place in September, always the Saturday after Labor Day. And then coming up, we have what's called Bourbon in the Bayou. It's a Fat Friday event with Kentucky Flair. It's a Mardi Gras style event with bourbon distilleries, tastings, full Cajun meals, silent live auctions. That takes place February, March, based on when Mardi Gras is. And so those are two of our big fundraising events. We have smaller ones throughout the year as well. And then we have some grants that we get. 3 years ago, now going on four, the state of Kentucky joined the 43 states ahead of us in having some state funding for the CASA program. And so that operates through a grant system. And for the CASA of Lexington program, that allows us to hire two of our 13 staff. So we're very thankful to have that funding, but it's not a cure-all in that we still rely largely on individual gifts and fundraisers. And again, we served 626 children last year, but there were over 1,500 substantiations. So we're nowhere near serving 100% of the need. And as we also already mentioned, CASA is an unduplicated resource. So if we're not working with that child, they're not receiving the same service anywhere else. So we definitely still have a long way to go. We're thrilled with the strides we've made. We definitely can use more support. So if people are interested, we'd love for them to get on our website, send an email, pick up the phone, give us a call, or even stop by.
And all they have to do is Google CASA, C-A-S-A, Lexington, right?
Yep. And the website is www.casaoflexington.org. We also have a Facebook page. It is Court Appointed Special Advocates of Lexington, which is what CASA stands for. And we'd love to talk with them more. There's opportunities for businesses to be sponsors. There are opportunities for individuals to sponsor a child with a CASA volunteer. There are fundraisers, as I mentioned, throughout the year. There's also ways to get involved from a material component. So we do the CASA Angel Tree every year. That's coming up, the kickoff. That's a chance to pick an actual child from here in our community off of the tree and help them with some basic needs. It might mean socks or a jacket. Also, it's going to have some wishes. Maybe they've always dreamed of an easy bake oven or a bicycle. And so someone can select those things for them, and then we get those gifts to the children. So there's ways to be involved that way. We've had church group or Girl Scout groups make blankets or personal hygiene kits. We really are a small enough nonprofit that we are willing to meet folks where they're at on how they want to get engaged. And I'm often notorious for saying it's a big problem, but it's going to take all of us playing our role to fix this issue of child abuse and child neglect.
Melinda Jameson is the executive director of the Lexington branch of the national nonprofit Court Appointed Special Advocates, or CASA. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also out there advocating for Kentucky children are the people who are helping gather vital data about them for the 2020 census. We're joined by Patricia Tenen, Chief Operating Officer of Kentucky Youth Advocates, and David Prince, Lawrence County teacher, musician, and a member of a local Complete Count committee. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Patricia, let's start with you. Tell us why it's important that we have a census in general for dollars and data and even democracy.
Yeah. So the decennial census, it's part of the Constitution that every 10 years we have to count every resident that lives within our borders. And it's been called the nation's largest peacetime mobilization. And those three D's that you brought up, so that data that is used from the census is critical for planning. It could be used for roads, bridges, you know, where businesses locate. It's for democracy, so that determines how many representatives we get in Congress. So in 1990, when we saw our population go down, we actually lost a representative there. But it's also used then to do legislative districts and local boards that determine that within states. But then the most important is the dollars, from my perspective as a child advocate, because there's over $800 billion in federal funding that comes down to states. And so if we are missing people, if we don't have a strong count, then we're not going to be pulling down those federal dollars that are used in local communities for schools, hospitals, and all these support services that are really important for our basic infrastructure.
Okay. And I want to come back to you to drill down into why this is important specifically to children in just a second. But David, from your perspective, why is a full and accurate census critical?
Well, among other things, as Patricia just mentioned, you can lose a House seat. And when we lost that seat after the 1990 census, that was our House seat in Eastern Kentucky. That was the 7th District, and we were sort of absorbed by the 5th and some of the 4th. And there was some talk at that time. I remember they were going to split my county in half, and half would have been in one district and half the other. So making sure everyone's counted and making sure we have the maximum amount of representation in Washington is extremely important.
Patricia, what is the importance of counting every child in 2020? Why is it important to children?
So we know that young children in particular, age 0 to 5, are the most undercounted group of any population. And so in 2010, it's estimated that we missed over 12,000 young children in that census. And why does that matter is because a lot of those federal funding streams are important for kids. So when we missed out for those children, that's, you know, 10 years is most of a childhood. You know, my daughter was born in 2009. If I wouldn't have counted her as an infant in the 2010 census, she just turned 10. So that would be 10 years of her life that wouldn't have, she wouldn't have been counted. And so what that leads to then is, you know, it could be overcrowded schools because we haven't planned for the children to be in those classrooms. It could be crowded emergency rooms, fewer childcare options. And so it's in our interest, with especially with such a high poverty rate in Kentucky, a child poverty rate, that we are accessing all of those federal dollars that we're eligible for to support our kids.
I know this is going to be really simplistic, but it seems to me that if you really boil this down, it's kind of like throwing an event where you're going to be serving food and you need a head count so that you make sure you have enough food.
I love that.
That works?
That works. That's that's perfect.
David, what does a complete count committee do?
Well, it's really interesting. A lady from the census, Karen Colburn, came in and helped us organize the committee. But you really want to use community members because no one knows your community better than the people who live there. So we organized and we invited people. We brainstormed to think about people who would have knowledge of the community. So we have a pastor from a local church. We have our chair is a school bus driver. I'm a teacher. We have a member there from the adult ed. And we have someone from the courthouse, the county judge executive, one of their people came in. So we want to involve as many people as we can who know the county and who know different demographics to make sure we're trying to reach out to those people who normally don't get counted.
And do you have enough people, do you think?
Not at all. We would love to have more people. And a lot of people you mentioned to said, that's wonderful, I'd like to come down. But then everyone's busy, and I understand that. And it's just we're asking for one more thing out of people. But if you know your community and you want to see them thrive, it would be nice to find. Every community has this, so seek those people out and join.
I think one thing that may not be understood out there is that census takers and certain positions involved in this are actually paid.
Absolutely. Some fairly nice money.
I think it's a weekly paycheck for the time that you're doing it. Patricia, maybe you can talk about this. Are field workers, the people who go out there and get these numbers, are they required to go into homes and actually interview people? And what kinds of questions do they ask?
Yeah. The first part of your question, it's actually new this year. They're taking a new approach. So most of the forms are going to be completed online. So the two dates that we're telling people is March Madness and Derby. So thinking about mid-March is when everybody's going to get a postcard sent to their house with instructions on how to fill it out online or by phone. So I think for a lot of people, that could be super convenient with a smartphone these days or just calling. For some households, particularly in your listening area, if they don't have high-speed internet or no internet access, that could pose a problem. So what will happen then, they'll be given a few reminders, and then they'll get a paper form that they can complete by mail. But then by April 1st, on that census day, then Derby is the first weekend in May. If they haven't completed it by then they'll be getting a knock on the door and someone who will be there to actually help them fill it out in person. So it's 9 simple questions for every person at that address. They're going to ask whether they rent or own the home, their sex, their age, and their race and ethnicity. And that's it. But we know for some households that can be kind of complex. And getting back to young children, why they might be undercounted, we know that one reason is when kids might be temporarily living with someone else, not their bio parents. And in Kentucky, that's pretty common that they're being raised by grandparents and other relatives, particularly for the age group 0 to 5. Estimates are that 11.6% of those kids are being raised by grandparents and who might think it's temporary It could be temporary, but they don't know whether they should count them or not. But they should. It's the guidance is that wherever they are resting their head on April 1st of 2020, if that's the place where they usually are, you know, sleeping most of the time, or if it's hard to determine where it is most of the time, on April 1st is the guideline there. And because that is a group that is at high risk of being undercounted. And
we do have a lot of children in foster care and kinship care in this
state. We do. We have the highest rate in the nation for kinship care.
And I want to add on to that, too. You get the situation where maybe there are some children staying in places where they're not supposed to be. And the people are afraid to count them because those children aren't supposed to be in that home. But the census has no interest in that. They just want to count the people.
Right. You're not taking names. You're just counting heads.
And correct me if I'm wrong. This information is sealed 72 years, correct?
That's right. It's completely confidential. The federal law says it can only be used for statistical purposes. So the Census Bureau employees have to take an oath that they will not use it for any other information. It can't be used for in court or by any government agencies. It's only for statistical purposes and punishable by 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine.
If you reveal it.
If you reveal it.
That's so important for people to know.
It's very important to know, yes.
I think we take the census for granted. It's always there. But I do a lot of research for Eastern Standard. And almost always, there's some reference to census data. It's more pervasive and more critical to our everyday lives than I think we recognize.
I think you're right, yes. And I know as us, we're constantly asking our legislators and leaders to make data-informed decisions. So we need to have really good, solid data. This, and I think it's a really basic tool, then that is used to make all kinds of other estimates that are, you know, that are built off of the census data. So we need it to be as strong as possible.
And as a teacher, I look at programs like Title I, Head Start. You know, those the funding is based on those numbers. And as you pointed out, it's a 10-year drought that's created if we undercount.
And so, Head Start is absolutely – it can make or break lives, can it?
I went to Head Start as a young person, and I turned out okay. So I think I'm an advocate of the program.
Wonderful.
Well, clearly, this is really important to each of you. But I wonder if you could just express why, in personal terms, why it's important that as a complete and accurate count as possible is obtained.
Well, in Appalachia, it seems like we're always fighting some sort of uphill battle. And that's just one more thing that creates problems by not having an accurate count, because then we lose representation, we lose federal dollars. And two, just for people to understand why we have a census and what those numbers are used for, because a lot of people, especially where I live in Eastern Kentucky, we don't always trust everyone and we don't want everyone to know our business. But this is clearly something that is not – there's no negative here, and you're only going to help your community by stepping forward and making sure we get everyone counted.
Patricia?
Well, I think David said it really well. You know, I was listening to another interview in California, the efforts that they're doing, and their state government has allocated $187 million just to the complete count effort, because they've realized there how important, what a big opportunity it is. It's only going to come around every 10 years. And so they're investing in it. They see an ROI. And Kentucky has we have zero allocated towards it. So I think, considering that we want Kentucky to be the best place in America to be young, and that we need resources to do that, I think we all need to be getting involved, because it's, you know, it's at the state level, but it's also our local communities that so many of us, those services that we rely on, that are going to push us forward and make us competitive with other states in the future, and make it improve the quality of life. So
if you're listening to this and you're thinking that you might like to take part, you might like to help out, and again, it is compensated. The census is looking for census takers, for recruiting assistants, for office clerks, for supervisory staff to get this job done. And there are tons of frequently asked questions online. I could give you the web address here on the radio, but it is long and complicated and probably would not be easy for you to jot down, especially if you're driving. We wouldn't want you to do that. So what I would ask you to do is go to our facts and information tab on our website, esweku.com, and we'll have a link to it right there. Patricia Tenen, Chief Operating Officer, Kentucky Youth Advocates, and David Prince, a teacher in Lawrence County. He's also a musician and a member of the local Complete Count Committee. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us. If you need someone to
count on, count me in. In a moment, a Kentuckian chosen for the first class of the new Appalachian Leadership Institute.
The Appalachian region has faced poverty rates above that of the nation for quite some time. And I think this Leadership Institute is really going to bring together leaders in the Appalachian region to try to tackle that problem.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Four Kentuckians were recently selected among 40 from across the region to join the first class of the new Appalachian Leadership Institute. Luke Glazer, Laura White-Brown, Colby Kirk, and with us now, Jesse Hunt, Financial Project Manager at FAHI, the Federation of Appalachian Housing Enterprises in Berea. Jesse holds an MBA from Morehead State University, and she has worked as a grant accountant here at EKU. We want to thank you for joining us, Jesse, and congratulations on your selection as an Appalachian Leadership Institute Fellow.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first, if you would, tell us a little bit about your day job at FAHI, the Federation of Appalachian Housing Enterprises. You're a project manager. What does that involve?
Yeah, so as a project manager at FAHI, I oversee an Appalachian Regional Commission power grant that we received in February. That grant is the Transformational Employment Program. It provides meaningful employment opportunities to people in recovery in six southeastern counties in the state. I also assist the team at FAHI with finding funds for affordable housing development projects. So like the Liberty Place here in Richmond, we actually were on the development team for that project. So that's kind of the things that I do. I oversee the Transformational Employment Program, and then I help the communities find funds for affordable housing projects as well.
So to the Appalachian Leadership Institute, from your perspective, why is there a need for this?
Well, the Appalachian region has faced poverty rates above that of the nation for quite some time. And I think this Leadership Institute is really going to bring together leaders in the Appalachian region to try to tackle that problem. A lot of that is caused by the opioid epidemic in Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, and the surrounding states. But there's a whole lot more that goes into that, too. Just access to health care, access to jobs, education, and transportation. So there's a lot of really big reasons why we're here, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see leaders from around the region come together and talk about all those issues and see how we can work together to come up with some good ideas.
There's no question now that the region really is going through a transition.
Right.
And so it sounds to me as though the intent here is to bring some leadership to the table, sort things out, and figure out the way forward.
Right.
There is a list of action items that have been laid out for you. I know you're just getting started with this, and so some of these can't even have been acted on by now, but I'd like to touch on a few that might call for your perspective. And one of them is to design effective economic development project proposals. Have anything in mind?
Yeah, so right now, the workforce participation rate in Kentucky is fairly low. So I feel like we could develop some kind of project proposal to help increase the workforce participation rate, which is kind of what we're doing with the Transformational Employment Program. But it's on a very small scale with only 6 counties. I feel like we could maybe blow that up a little bit.
And does this involve job training and retraining? For example, coal miners who are now out of work looking for another line of work?
Right. So that's definitely something to bring to the Leadership Institute. The program that we currently have only focuses on people in recovery. But yes, as far as effective economic development project proposals, that's something that we should look at as people affected by the coal mining.
Another action item is to integrate community assets into long-lasting economic development strategies. What does that mean to you?
To me, I've talked a lot with people from more mountainous communities than Berea, so say down in Harlan. And some of the biggest issues that they face is access to transportation. So I feel like being able to obtain community assets and implement some kind of transportation strategy in more mountainous communities is definitely a need. And I'm looking forward to speaking with some other leaders that might have already implemented something similar to that.
And what about the mountains themselves as assets? If we're thinking in the context of developing tourism, for example, might it be an opportunity to take advantage of what's been a difficult terrain in
yes.
terms of transportation, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it can become advantageous.
Right, right. I think Berea does a great job of using their culture and community to attract tourism, and I feel like we could move that to other areas. So, yeah, definitely.
One other action item that I think is right up your alley, and that's preparing competitive applications for public grant opportunities. Do you plan to bring your skills in that area to the table?
Yeah. So most of my skills are around the afterward. So here at Eastern, we had 2 separate departments, a pre-award department and a post-award department. And I worked with post-award, so I didn't have a whole lot to do with actually writing the grant application, seeking those funds, as much as managing them after they were already here. However, at FAHI, we have written several since I started, so I'm getting a little more experience with that piece of it. I am looking forward to hearing from other leaders in the area that have more experience with actually writing grant applications and project proposals. But I think that we already have a really strong set of staff at FAHI that's doing that, so I'm learning a lot from them as well.
So I just want to know what it means to you personally, Jesse, to be involved in the work of the Appalachian Leadership Institute.
You know, I was shocked, honestly, after the press release came out and said that there were a little over 180 applicants and only 40 were selected. I was excited and shocked that I was even chosen. But in the application process, I was just honest about my experience of living here and growing up here. My family is actually tobacco farmers.
From where exactly?
Well, Estill County. So they had a farm in Estill County, and we also leased a farm on Duncannon right here in Richmond. So I grew up there until I was about 14, and that's whenever the government offered a buyout for tobacco farmers, and they ended up retiring out of that. But I can remember when I was younger, I was too little to ride the tobacco setter at the time, but my grandfather would always tell us to walk behind and push the plants down until we found the water, you know, the ones that wouldn't go all the way in. So I remember that, the hard work of Appalachian people and how hard it was to make a living. And so when I was given the opportunity to apply for the Leadership Institute, I said, you know, I think I could make a difference and make that easier for people in Appalachian communities to make a living and try to make ends meet.
Jesse Hunt is Financial Project Manager at the Federation of Appalachian Housing Enterprises in Berea, that's better known as FAHI. And she has been selected by the Appalachian Regional Commission to participate in the inaugural class of the Appalachian Leadership Institute. Thanks for coming in, Jesse.
Yeah, thank you.
Who?
Who?
What?
What?
Where?
Where?
When?
When?
Why?
Apple Shop in Whitesburg has officially kicked off a year-long celebration of its 50th anniversary, and you can get all the details online at appleshop.org. But Alexandra Werner-Winslow joins us now from Apple Shop in Whitesburg with the details of an anniversary celebration event that's coming up next month. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Tom.
So tell us what's going on on November 8th, is that right?
That is right. We're having an event out here on Friday, November 8th. Actually, we'll have two events on that date. The Pine Mountain Sessions, which you may have heard about as a benefit for Pine Mountain, as well as the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust, that album features a number of artists and poets who are reading their work. And some of those artists and poets will be here on Friday, November 8th, to perform their work. But that's not the only event that's happening that night. We also will have an artist here in our Apple Shop gallery named Julian Davis, who will be presenting their work, some paintings that pair really nicely with that album because a number of those paintings were inspired by murder ballads, if you can believe it. So it will really be a musical night here at Apple Shop, the first of many events that we'll have monthly all through our 50th year.
Okay, and we're going to have a lot more on Apple Shop's 50 years coming up soon on an edition of Eastern Standard. In fact, probably quarterly is what we're talking about. But in the meantime, that's Apple Shop Communications Director Alexandra Werner-Winslow in Whitesburg. Thanks so much, Alexandra.
Thank you.
Are you an aspiring or even an intermediate entrepreneur? Are you part of an organization with a social enterprise idea? There's an opportunity coming up to join the social enterprise movement in Appalachia. The third annual Central Appalachian Social Enterprise Summit is scheduled for November 19th, 2019 at Tamarack in Beckley, West Virginia. Google Central Appalachian Social Enterprise Summit. You'll pull up tons of information about it. And Bill Goodman and his crew at Kentucky Humanities have been hard at work putting together the lineup for a 2019 book fair. Lots of authors speaking, holding panel discussions. You can check out the new Appalachian Women panel, for example. Scheduled keynote speakers, Scott Pelley of CBS's 60 Minutes, and CNN's Jim Acosta, author of The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. This is happening November 10th through the 16th at the Kentucky Horse Park near Lexington. Next week on Eastern Standard, a new edition. Stephanie Lang of the Kentucky Historical Society joins our team of interviewers, beginning with a conversation with University of Kentucky anthropologist Zeta Kamara, who focuses on Central and Southern Appalachian historical archaeology, oral history, public history, and rural sociology.
So I'm curious, how did you become involved in Appalachian historical archaeology?
That's a good question. People always like to ask archaeologists about our origin story. I think they're expecting something glamorous that has to do with Egypt.
And we learn from Stephanie's interview that this archaeology thing began at a very early age for Zeta Kamara.
Actually, I grew up in an Appalachian community in rural northwestern Pennsylvania, very rural. We were pretty poor when I was younger, and one of the things my brother and I like to do is dig in the trash midden under my parents' house, which is pretty old, a couple hundred years old, and we would dig up the toys of other children that had come before us. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's my origin story, but I think it's really because I was always aware of my status as an other in my own community because of material culture.
Also in next week's show, four Kentucky universities converge to create the University Center of Southern Kentucky in Somerset. Director Trent Poole will have all the details. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, on our website, esweku.com, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we love to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.